Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The stimulus anniversary highlights the partisan divide. President Obama promises billions in loan guarantees for a pair of new nuclear reactors. And it was Biden versus Cheney on the Sunday morning shows, with the current vice president saying of his predecessor, quote, "He either is misinformed or he is misinforming." Joining me for the domestic hour of our Friday news roundup, Susan Page of USA Today, Melinda Henneberger of PoliticsDaily.com, and Jerry Seib at The Wall Street Journal. You are always a part of the program, so I hope you'll join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org, and you can also send us a tweet or join us on Facebook. Good morning, everybody. Happy
morning.
Friday.
Good morning.
And happy end of this snow in this Washington area. Jerry Seib, I hope you've been traveling well throughout it all, but yesterday, the president, or Wednesday, he was defending his stimulus plan. The question is, how well has it worked?
Well, you know, I wrote in a column today that the one thing you can be sure of is it hasn't been as useful as the White House says or as useless as the Republicans claim. So I think it's probably somewhere in the middle. I mean, this has been the economic debate of the week in Washington. What did the stimulus do or not do? The White House says it saved or created, and that's a pretty fuzzy definition, 2 million jobs. I talked to an economist this week who said, well, maybe $1 million of those jobs is fluff. So somewhere in that range, it's probably added a point or two to the economic growth in this year, which is actually picking up. I think the most interesting thing about the stimulus, and by the way, only about a third of the stimulus package is out the door. There's a lot more to be spent this year. So I think the most interesting thing is that because the critics were right on one point, which is that a lot of this infrastructure spending goes out the door very slowly and didn't help in job creation all that much in 2009. There's a lot more of it that's going to go out the door in 2010. So it's actually beneficial to the White House that when they really need some punch for on economic matters for political reasons, they might get a little this year.
And those political reasons, Susan, are the elections coming up quite soon.
And we see that Republicans have made a big attack point on Democrats who supported the stimulus package, that it's wasteful, that it's big government, that it's contributed to these huge deficits. So at the moment, it's an issue that I think is hurting Democrats. But as Jerry says, if it helps, clearly helps turn the economy, clearly helps reduce this 9.7% unemployment rate we have now, that will be helpful to Democrats and to the White House.
Now, Melinda, there had been so much talk about working together here. Has there been any of that?
Working together to agree on whether the stimulus worked or not?
No,
zero.
To agree on what they could do to move ahead.
Well, the thing is, the debate keeps moving, because when Republicans say this will be on deficit reduction, for example, oh, this is a jammy idea, until the Democrats agree, and then they say, well, maybe not so jammy after all. So, no, I don't see what's going to happen in that regard. And on Susan's point, too, you know, these Republicans who are making a lot of political hay out of saying that the stimulus hasn't been very effective. The Center for American Progress, just put out a report saying that there are 111 Republicans who have taken big-time credit for these stimulus projects in their own districts, while at the same time taking credit for opposing the stimulus that got them the project. So it's either one or the other.
I have to say, Diane, I think I see less willingness to work together on any issue than I've ever seen in the time I've been in Washington. And that goes to working on deficit reduction. It goes to trying to figure out a health care bill. It goes to getting an energy bill. People on both parties seem at such cross purposes, so focused on the politics of the moment, the politics of November, that it's going to be a struggle to get much of anything done, I think, this
so
year.
It's far more than just legitimate philosophical differences.
Well, certainly, just look at the debt reduction panel commission that the president named yesterday. You know, this was an idea that had bipartisan support until it came up for a vote about 2 weeks ago. Seven Republicans who had co-sponsored legislation to establish the commission voted against it and brought it down. And it's hard to see any reason for that happening except for politics.
Jerry?
Well, and I think the debt commission does crystallize a lot of this in the sense that the very reason that the two parties can't get together on this is that they both know they would have to do something that would be unpopular with their base, and nobody in Washington seems to do that right now. Republicans would have to be prepared to accept the idea of tax increases to reduce the deficit. Democrats would have to be willing to accept the idea of some reduction over time in Social Security and Medicare spending and acknowledge those things up front before they voted on something. And nobody wants to do that. So if you're not willing to do those two basic things, what is the point? And that's really where the debt commission has sort of crystallized this whole gap. And I think the reason for the gap is pretty simple. There are few people left in the center of the political spectrum in Washington these days, and so there's nobody to build the bridge.
So you've got former Senator Alan Simpson. You've got former White House Chief of Staff Erskine Bowles. What are they assigned to do, Melinda?
Well, they're assigned to figure out whether there's a way to bring the Treasury Department in to oversee more regulation of the banks and get banks, particularly lending again to small businesses, which I think everybody can agree the banks behaved so badly before, during, and after the crisis that somebody needs to take them by the hand. As a political matter, to put the Treasury Department in charge of that seems a little bit dicey. I mean, it would be a huge shift. So I don't know. But I think one of the best things about it is bringing Alan Simpson back to the stage, always an enjoyable person to cover and quote.
But certainly effective.
Well, Alan Simpson's highly, highly respected. And he noted one tool in the interviews he did. He did a series of interviews yesterday. One of the tools he said he would have is humor. And that can be a powerful thing. On the other hand, overcoming some of the kind of institutional infrastructure problems they'll have in reaching a deal is pretty formal. You know, just to pick up on Jerry's point about there being nobody left in the middle, I was at the Conservative Political Action Conference yesterday, and the American Conservative Union puts out this scorecard of all the members of Congress, and there is no overlap in the Senate. The most liberal Republican is more conservative than the most conservative Democrat. So that just shows you how extraordinarily polarized the two parties are. There is literally no one in the middle.
Yeah. What else went on at that gathering?
You know, this is a group that began meeting during the Nixon administration, and since then they've been a real forum, a showcase for the most conservative Americans, and the most conservative political activists. A year ago, this was a pretty downbeat group. You know, President Obama had just been inaugurated. Democrats just gotten these gains in the House and the Senate. But at the convention that started yesterday, they are really energized. They are convinced there will be big conservative victories in November, and convinced also, as Vice President Cheney told them yesterday, former Vice President Cheney, in a surprise appearance, he told them President Obama will be a one-term president. That got a lot of cheers.
Melinda?
I remember attending last year that the highlight, the news of last year's CPAC was Ann Coulter making a remark that John Edwards was gay. I guess we've since learned that's not true. But this year, the headline is their embrace of the Tea Party movement. You know, John Boehner got up yesterday in what I thought was one of the most interesting speeches and threw his arms around the Tea Party movement and said, "We are your party. We don't want to co-opt you. We want to listen to you. We want to work side by side."
How does and the that, Tea Party feel about that?
You know, well, one of the most interesting speeches I thought was by Dick Armey, who, you know, used to be a leader of the Republican Party. He got up. He now heads an organization called Freedom Works. It's been part of the Tea Party movement. He got up and said and warned Republicans. He said they have to prove themselves to the Tea Party movement, and they aren't just going to believe their assurances that they're with them on the big issues. He said, I'm from Texas, and you can say you're a cowboy, but I won't believe you until you show me how you ride.
Jerry.
Woo-hoo.
Well, look, I think it is, this reminds me somewhat of 1980 when I first got to Washington and Ronald Reagan did something that was considered pretty radical at the time, and he embraced the religious right. And the Republicans had been unwilling to do it before then. He did it very openly in his 1980 campaign. It was very beneficial for Republicans, but it also created some problems for Republicans. They had to sort of buy into the agenda of the religious right, and there were some Republicans who over the years ceased to be Republicans because of that. Republicans now are going to have similar problems. I mean, there are issues on the Patriot Act and immigration and things like that where the Tea Party movement is not where a lot of the mainstream of the Republican Party is, and they're going to have to figure out how to resolve those things. Now, this is clearly a good thing for Republicans overall. I'm just saying it is not without its problems.
Of course, as former Vice President Cheney stood on that platform, I gather they were saying, run, Dick, run.
You know, I was there, and that was scattered chance. This did not, the idea of Dick Cheney running again for public did not seize the entire audience, I don't think. But he's clearly a popular figure. There was a lot of, there was sort of that feeling that, you know how disheartened Republicans were at the end of the Bush administration, and then especially with the loss of the White House, there was kind of a feeling that the Bush-Cheney administration was back. President Bush got a little bit of praise as well.
Well, but there are a lot of critics of the Bush-Cheney administration in that room, too. And I personally wondered if some of the applause for Dick wasn't because he was putting his daughter forward, and I think she's even more popular in that room.
Melinda Henneberger, she's editor-in-chief for PoliticsDaily.com. We'll take a short break. When we come back, more news, your calls, and comments. Welcome back to the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup this week with Melinda Henneberger of PoliticsDaily.com, Jerry Seib at The Wall Street Journal, Susan Page of USA Today. I look forward to hearing your questions, comments. Do join us. Jerry Seib, the news on the economic front was kind of mixed this week. You had U.S. workers filing new applications for unemployment insurance surging, and you had the Fed bumping up this special rate for banks. How does all that fit together, or does it?
Well, it doesn't really neatly, but yet another thing this week, which is there were signs that manufacturing activity is starting to pick up in the U.S., and that's what is needed to before hiring, real hiring, actually starts to take place. So you have a lot of mixed signals right now. I think the Fed was moving. What it did was it raised the rate on the loans that it gives banks on an emergency basis. I think it was trying to not signal it's about to raise interest rates because it's too soon to do that, but saying banks should go out into the private market and find their own money, not borrow it from us, the Fed. That's actually a good sign because it means the Fed thinks there's money out there for banks to go get. And prices are not going up, so inflation seems to be under control. The problem is this jobless claims number that you just suggested. They went up again, and that was a surprise. And it once again shows the contours of a kind of a jobless recovery so far. And if you want to add up all the numbers we're talking about here, that's kind of the picture you still get.
You have to wonder at the same time the impact of these unemployment fears, Melinda, that are sort of affecting everything and everybody across the country.
Everything. And I think that's why you see only something like there was a New York Times poll that found that 6% of Americans felt that the stimulus package had any effect on jobs. And that's why, because that's not something that's the effect of a misfiring PR campaign. People know, can feel joblessness in their lives and their friends' lives and their community. And this is, I think, the biggest problem that the administration and the country has probably right now.
Sure. And even if the economists tell the Wall Street Journal that there's a recovery, you can't persuade anybody about it. And the White House, in fact, has been very careful never to say that the economy is recovering without saying, but joblessness is too high, and we know that's a problem. We're going to keep working on it.
I'm interested in why the president has reversed himself on this question of nuclear energy. Susan, for a long time, he was saying no to that portion of alternative energy options. Why now?
I think it's part of an effort to get an energy bill through Congress. Nuclear power is more popular among Republicans than among Democrats. He announced in the State of the Union address that he would increase funding to try to boost the construction of new nuclear power plants. Boy, we haven't done that since the 1970s. That was one of the very few lines in the State of the Union that got some applause from the Republican side of the aisle. On Tuesday, he announced $8.3 billion in loan guarantees to help construct two nuclear power plants in Georgia. Now, the question is, will Republicans respond by willing to then make a deal on some of the things important to Democrats in the energy bill? And that we don't know yet.
The whole question of waste disposal is still out there, is it not, Jerry?
Sure. No, it is. And it's probably less close to being resolved than it was a few years ago, because I think the idea of just taking it all to Yucca Mountain in Nevada is pretty much off the table. But what's changed, the politics around it have changed nonetheless, in the sense that a lot of people, not all the people by any means, but a lot of people in the environmental movement now have embraced nuclear power as an alternative to burning fossil fuels, and that makes it possible for a Democratic president to do this. But I think Susan is exactly right. What's changed in the politics in Washington on this subject are that everybody, I think, now will admit that there's not going to be a big greenhouse gas global warming cap and trade bill that gets through Congress this year. I see no way that happens. So the best the White House can hope for is a bill that encourages uses of alternative energy without doing a cap-and-trade system that it can call a climate change bill. And to do that, you really have to put a nuclear energy component into it.
Now, does he risk alienating some of his own base, Melinda, with this?
Well, I would say that some of his base is pretty alienated as it is, but yes and no. I think that even the environmentalists are divided on this issue. There are a lot of the green movement that really sees this as something that does have to happen, and saying safety is a lot greater now than, you know, it was when we had the situation at Three Mile Island. We have a writer, Jill Lawrence, who used to work with Susan, who covered Three Mile Island in 1979, and she wrote a column for us today saying that she very well remembers being sent out in her hazmat suit and being told by her editor, gee, I hope this doesn't affect your child-rearing possibilities.
Well, you know, I also covered Three Mile Island. I was working for Newsday then, and I was a young reporter, and they called me in the middle of the night, and they said, there's been some kind of nuclear accident in Pennsylvania. Why don't you drive there?
Oh.
So I got in my little car, and I'm driving. I'm thinking, why am I
Chief,
driving
Chief,
there?
Nothing I'd rather do.
Yeah. And what did you find when
I found a situation where people were panicked, and no official had the slightest idea what to tell us.
They told you to close your windows, right?
There was a classic example of a kind of a lack of information and inability to explain to people. And boy, has the nuclear industry paid for the consequences of that since then.
You know, I was thinking about the tragedy in Austin, Texas, yesterday, where an apparently suicidal individual used his small Cessna plane to dive bomb and hit the IRS because he had a huge grudge. It does raise, once again, concerns about safety, who gets into airplanes, what kinds of authority they have. Jerry, I don't know how that story hit you.
Well, I could tell you exactly how it hit me, because I was sitting in my office and there was the news of the plane in Austin, and it was, you know, planes flying into buildings. You know, we remember that. And then at the same time, and this turned out not to be a big deal, but there was a plane headed from Denver to San Francisco that was diverted to land in Utah because of a bomb threat. And I thought, I've seen this movie before and it doesn't have a good ending. This is how it felt to be in the office watching the first news of 9/11 come in. You know, one incident, another incident, and then all of a sudden you realize there's something giant and awful happening. That's not what happened yesterday. But still, none of us who've lived through that, and that's most of the country, obviously, can escape those feelings.
And you've still got Homeland Security. I mean, now apparently they're going to test hands for any trace of explosives. I wonder how that is going to affect our safety, Melinda.
When something like this happens, it's very frightening. But the first thing I think yesterday was, you know, we always want to know why when someone commits suicide, but I always think it's important to remember that there's really only one reason, and that's the disease of depression. Beyond that, I thought what was frightening about this guy's long manifesto was its lucidity. And his rants were pretty well phrased. But in terms of our safety, I think that the problem is so much that goes on in the name of Homeland Security that doesn't make us any safer. You know, that, you know, grandmas being patted down and taking their shoes off. And, you know, a lot of it just seems to be stuff that makes us feel like we're doing something, but that really doesn't make us a bit safer. Yeah. I would hope that that this prospect of testing the hands for some kind of explosives would actually have some practical merit.
Here's a message from Facebook. Susan wants to know, could we hear more about the Democrats using reconciliation for the health care bill? Susan.
Well, we now have seen 18 senators sign up to support the idea of using this procedure called reconciliation to try to get some of this health care bill through. Reconciliation only requires 51 votes, not the 60 that you need if you're going to use the regular order. And, of course, since you've got, what do you have now, 59 Democratic senators, you presume you might be able to get 51 votes.
And certainly at least one and more on their way out. Evan Bayh on Monday said he would not seek re-election. He said there is no longer this collaboration within the Congress. Hasn't been there for a long time. Jerry, what was your reaction?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I did an interview and a column with Evan Bayh a couple of weeks earlier, and I certainly didn't see his resignation coming. That was a surprise. But you could just sense the frustration that the guy was feeling. And he was arguing. And we started out this conversation talking about the inability of the two parties to come together and how the Debt Commission had kind of crystallized that inability. Well, that was very much Evan Bayh's view. He was had pushed for months, really. He was one of the first people in this go-around to push for a resolution in which Democrats and Republicans would come together and agree on a plan to form a commission that would work across party lines to cut the deficit, and he couldn't get it done. That was frustrating. He wanted his party to move more to the political center. He felt that wasn't happening. And he said as much when he announced that he was retiring. And that, I think, really is what got people to open their eyes a little wider and say, wow, there is a feeling that nothing really gets done around here anymore.
Melinda.
Well, I think people felt like that for a while, but I don't see that Evan Bayh could have left in any more graceless or angry way. I mean, it was really such a stink bomb to throw in, you know, his own party, and to announce this the day before the deadline for filing in his home state to replace him for the Democratic Party, knowing that no one could possibly get 5,000 signatures in 12 hours.
So nobody had any idea that this was coming?
Well, I'm told that the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid got a call from him 45 minutes before he told the whole world. So that's not much advance notice. And this is bad news for Democrats. You know, Indiana
Horrible.
Is a pretty red state. He's done very well there. He won election as governor twice and as senator twice. Not clear there's another Democratic candidate who can carry Indiana.
That's why I was asking about reconciliation, because this takes the numbers that much farther down.
He may think, though, that this will play very well in his state, where he may want to get his old job as governor back, or even he has hinted run as a third-party candidate, and so he may think that that goes very well
It's hard for me to see by running as a third-party candidate, but he definitely, I think, tried to lay some groundwork for the governor's race there in 2 years. And he would be, I think, in a pretty strong position. He made the case he didn't hate politics. He said he didn't love the Congress, but he said he really saw himself as an executive. That would be a governor or a president.
Right. Susan Page, she's Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want to ask you all about Cheney versus Biden. What happened, Susan?
We saw this extraordinary Washington debate last Sunday where Vice President Biden up in Vancouver did a taped interview on one Sunday show. And then on a second Sunday show, former Vice President Cheney responded to what Biden had said, was very critical of the administration. And then on the third Sunday show, Biden came back in a live interview and responded to what Cheney had said, responding to what he had said. So we had this debate of the vice presidents where they weren't actually even in the same country, but a very Washington moment, and a big debate about that centered mostly on U.S. policy toward terrorism. How do we take terrorists? Dick Cheney came out once again in favor of waterboarding of the Christmas Day bomber and against the prosecution of terror suspects in civilian courts.
Jerry.
And, you know, and I think the Democratic response to that is, look, we're treating the Christmas Day bomber the same way the Bush administration treated Richard Reid, the shoe bomber, A. And B, we now have 30,000 more troops in Afghanistan going after the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. So what's your problem? Now, that's in a way, that's the form of this debate. And the interesting thing, one of the interesting things about this exchange is it basically compelled Dick Cheney to say, look, I actually didn't agree with what the Bush administration was doing at the end, which we all kind of knew. But to make his case, which he makes very strongly, he has to sort of acknowledge that by the end of the Bush administration, it was drifting away from what Dick Cheney views is the maximum stand for protecting the U.S.
How popular is Dick Cheney in this country right now?
Well, not very. I mean, I don't think he's that popular with conservatives or certainly anybody in the Democratic Party. But he's criticized a lot for arguing with the president at all during wartime. And I don't think that's right. I think that liberals who were very impatient for Al Gore to take after George Bush before he did should not now say that a vice president out of office has no standing to criticize the president. I would criticize him on the merits when he gets up and says this president acts like we're not at war. Well, I would say he just sent an awful lot of young men and women to fight in Afghanistan for a guy who thinks we're not at war. Or yesterday at CPAC when Liz Cheney said this president on terror matters is so his incompetence is getting people killed. This in the week that we had two major victories in Pakistan in the war on terror. So I would criticize him on the merits of what he's saying.
The last time we looked at Dick Cheney's favorable rating in the USA Today Gallup poll, it was about 2-1 negative. And in that way, the White House may be just as happy to have Vice President Cheney be the one articulating this case against him, because he doesn't have credibility with a lot of Americans, although he has enormous credibility with one group of Americans, like the people who were gathered at CPAC this week.
All right. I'm going to open the phones, take one call before the break. Let's go to Grapevine, Texas. Good morning, Evelyn. You're on the air.
Yes. I'm kind of concerned about this CPAC Republican Tea Partiers. You know, you just can't keep telling all these lies, and I just can't believe that people are believing them.
Wait, are they telling lies, Susan?
They're telling, by and large, there are things you could fact check about statements that are made in speeches, but by and large, they're expressing their political point of view, which is a very conservative one.
Jerry?
Well, I agree with that, and I think that, you know, they're... The issue here is the way you interpret what Washington is doing right now. You know, is this a lot of what's happened in the last year that Democrats would describe as emergency measures needed to rescue the country from the worst economic crisis in 75 years, and people in the conservative and Tea Party movement describe as, you know, government overreach and creeping socialism, you know, taking over the country. Well, you look at the same set of facts and you can argue both those cases. And that, in a sense, is what's going on right now.
Well, and
I think this Tea Party is a name that means a lot of different things to a lot of different Tea Partiers themselves. I mean, you know, supposedly healthcare reform was what mobilized a lot of these people initially, and yet, in almost inevitably, when you interview anybody in those crowds, their complaints were much more diverse, were really kind of all over the map, and they didn't always agree with each other.
Melinda Hanneberger, she's editor-in-chief of PoliticsDaily.com. Short break, more of your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, celebrating Black History Month and investing in strong futures for kids at aecf.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. More top Taliban leaders captured. A Haitian judge releases 8 American missionaries, and the UN climate chief quits. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. A little humor for the morning. Here's an email saying, I'm encouraged by Cheney's statement about Obama being a one-term president, since Cheney has been consistently wrong about almost everything. Let's go back to the phones to Rochester, New York. Good morning, Paul. You're on the air.
Good morning, everyone.
Hi.
This is in regards to a jobs creation bill and also something that has been going on for a long time. I just want to inform people, and a lot of you probably already know this, that the largest part of our deficit is owed to ourselves. And one of those main portions of our deficit that, or I let me get my terms right here. The debt, not the deficit, the largest part of our debt, of the $10 trillion that we owe in debt, is owed to Social Security and to our retirement funds. Ronald Reagan raised the Social Security rate, or the payroll tax, from 11% to 15%. And that was foreseeing the baby boomers coming up, and it was going to set money aside for us for when we got older. So we have amassed $2.5 trillion that we have set aside for us for when we got older. And here we are in a situation where we're competing against other countries that don't have those same things. And I work in manufacturing in Rochester, New York. And I will tell you that since 1986, I've seen the decline in manufacturing. As a person or whatever, I need to make things with my hands. I can't see myself doing anything else.
I understand. Jerry Saab, do you want to comment?
Well, look, it's certainly correct, and that is the part of this debt problem that everybody has seen coming for 20 years and has done really nothing to resolve, which is the reality that in over the next 10 to 20 years, the biggest part of the debt that the country's on track to accumulate is going to be accumulated to finance Social Security and Medicare. There's another part of this, though, that I think is going to be troubling to people increasingly as they figure it out, which is that as the debt piles up, a huge part of the deficit that the government runs every year is simply to pay the interest on that debt. I mean, it's a giant part of the bill. And so, in a sense, we're borrowing money from China and then paying interest on the money that we've borrowed from China. And one of the things that the debt commission that we were talking about earlier has been asked to do is figure out a way to balance the budget by 2015, except for the interest on the debt, which will still be paid out of deficit funds.
And in fact, the interest on the debt by 2014 on the path we're on will be greater than domestic spending. Federal domestic spending will be spending
Paul
more
has
on interest
reason
on the debt.
To be very concerned.
He does.
Here's an email from Brian in Dallas, Texas. Why is the Fed holding interest rates so low when the rates are not being passed on to American consumers and business, which are essential to spurring economic growth? All the low interest rates are doing is allowing banks to borrow money to gamble in the stock market. Once again, our economic growth is a financial fabrication, unsustainable because we're not producing anything. And that goes right to Paul's point. Melinda.
And to the point, and to the argument that the banks need to be regulated in whatever way we need to do that, even if it means having Treasury essentially tell them what to do.
Jerry.
Well, one of the problems here is that banks have been told by regulators and are about to be told in a new financial regulatory bill, if it ever gets passed, that they need to rework their balance sheets, rebuild their capital, get less leveraged. They're using the money to do that as well. And that's, in the long run, a good thing. You know, one of the things that's happening right now is that U.S. banks are in much better shape than, for example, European banks because they've done that hard work. And it doesn't show up yet, but it's starting to show up. The second thing is, you know, there are a lot of Americans who have refinanced their mortgages in the last few months. Not as many as some people think ought to because the standards have gone up, but there is some benefit there. The third thing I would say is that, as the Fed indicated yesterday, we're nearing the end of this near zero interest rate, not imminently, but sometime this year. Here.
All right. Pardon me. Here are two related emails. The first from Rochester, New York. Someone who writes in says, I'm still trying to understand why Republicans are gaining popularity by voting no to everything. I would think the public would be turned off by this kind of obstruction. And then Barbara from Boulder, Colorado writes, I don't understand why Harry Reid doesn't force Republicans to stand up and talk for hours and hours the way it was done in the past. Wouldn't the act of stopping the Senate's work expose Republicans to more media scrutiny? As it is, the filibuster vote seems like any other, which it shouldn't be and isn't Susan.
Well, lots of complaints about the way the filibuster is now used all the time against all kinds of bills, when it used to be a kind of an extraordinary measure that was used only occasionally. I would say that in our polling, the Republican Party is not getting more popular. What's happening is the Democrats are getting less popular. But the strategy that Republicans have not really rebuilt their brand with voters. But we do see, as a result, I think, of the continuing economic problems and especially unemployment, that President Obama is less popular and congressional Democrats are less popular. And there is some significant concerns, especially among independent voters, those voters in the middle, about the size of the government and these billion-dollar bailouts and what that's going to mean over the long term.
Well, I think the reality is there are three or four big initiatives the Obama administration took or had to take, depending on your point of view, in 2009 that have not proven to be very popular. One was obviously the health care bill, which has declined steadily in popularity. The second one was bailing out GM and Chrysler. The third was finishing the bank bailouts. And all of those things, as it happens, have not turned out to be wildly popular moves with the country at large. And if you do those things, you pay a price, and that's what's happened.
A lot of people are looking at President Obama, his leadership. What about Harry Reid and his leadership, Melinda?
Well, he's in a real problem right now, especially because he's trying to be reelected. I mean, he doesn't want to do the usual thing of starting in the middle and working out. He wants to start from the left and work to the right with any of his legislative packages. I mean, that and why? Because he doesn't want to lose the liberal support that he's going to need to get reelected, and it's already going to be a very tough proposition for him.
Susan,
I didn't mean to interrupt.
Clearly, one of the most endangered Democrats running for reelection this year is Harry Reid, and that would be a big prize for Republicans to take down the majority leader.
All right, let's go to Dallas, Texas. Stephen, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I'll be brief. I was just calling because I'd like to encourage the media representatives on your panel and otherwise to call a spade with regards to the gentleman in Austin who flew his plane into a government building. He is nothing short of a terrorist. I mean, he targeted a government entity. He tried to kill as many people as possible. Was not an act of suicide. It was absolutely an act of terrorism. And he's no different than the 19 people who hijacked planes on 9/11.
It's an interesting perspective, Jerry.
Yeah, and I think it's hard to dispute that. I mean, I think everybody has agreed that the Oklahoma City bombers in the 90s were terrorists as well. The bizarre twist to this one is he seemingly tried to kill his own wife and child before he tried to kill those people in the IRS
burning
building.
Burning their house down.
Yeah, which is a sign of something way beyond even terrorism. I don't know what.
Susan, is the media using or are the media using the wrong term here?
Well, there is a debate about what exactly do you mean by terrorism. Should it be kind of reserved for to people who are, attacking kind of the fundamentals of the government or the nation as a whole?
Well, it was the IRS.
It was the IRS. It's certainly terrifying. And so I don't have a problem with calling it terrorism, but it is something that there's some debate about.
Susan Page of USA Today, Jerry Seib of The Wall Street Journal, Melinda Henneberger of PoliticsDaily.com. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Indianapolis. Good morning, Amber. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Diane. I just wanted to make a comment. I'd like to say that the message that the Republicans and the Conservative Party is changing me as a human being, it's hurting me and causing me to lose faith in the bipartisanship of this country. I am a non-party person. I've always voted just for the person that I liked their message and what they had to say. And I don't think that the Republicans and the Conservative Party realize that this campaign of hate and refusal to compromise with any of Obama's plans, except if they have to do with war and going and killing people, that it's disheartening and it's changing me as a human being. And I'm just really, it's emotionally troubling to me.
Interesting. I hear a lot of that, Susan.
You know, Jerry talked earlier in the show about the cost to Republicans for embracing kind of the most vociferous voices. And Amber's vote might be one of those costs, or Amber's comfort with thinking of herself as a conservative or a Republican or voting for a Republican if the party seems to be taken over by the harshest voices around.
But let me read for you this email. This is from Deborah, who says, I'm a Democrat, quite frustrated with my party. They seem to lack courage and leadership to lead. Why can't they sum up the current mood of their Republican counterparts and go forward with strategies that go around them? They spend so much time wringing their hands and fretting about rising Republican support and not enough time talking about the issues, arguing their stand, and just going forward using the channels they have. Melinda.
Well, I think there's something to that stereotype of hand-wringing Democrats, but I also think that because the country is in dire straits, the Democrats haven't really gotten credit even for some of the things that they were able to accomplish this year. I mean, they did pass the stimulus bill, whether you like it or not, and they did have the GM takeover, whether you like it or not. They passed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. They reversed the ban on stem cell. I mean, they had a pretty active year. So to say that they were just wringing hands, I think, is
unfair. But they're not getting credit for it.
That's right.
I think that the media have focused on what hasn't gotten done and the arguments that continue in Washington rather than pointing out the accomplishments.
That's kind of in the nature of the news business. Norm Ornstein, who's a frequent guest on your show, has made the argument this is really one of the most productive Congresses. But those high-profile issues on which the administration put their most of their chips, those are the ones that haven't gotten done. So not surprising, I think, that that's where the news media is focused.
One correction from Max in St. Louis. Published reports state it was a Piper aircraft and not a Cessna. I apologize for that error. Let's go back to the phones to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, Roger.
Thank you, Diane. I have a question concerning the U.S. economic situation. Because our country is in a deep recession, it's very good that the media is looking into many different aspects of unemployment and job creation. So I'd like to know why the mainstream media is not reporting the major story that the U.S. government, since the beginning of the recession last year, has continued to give an additional 1.5 million foreign citizens annually either green cards or temporary work permits to come to America and take U.S. jobs. This failure to report is due to sloppy journalism, or maybe it's the result of bias and a political agenda on part of the mainstream media.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling.
Well, I read a recent report that there are actually many fewer illegal immigrants in this country. That number has dropped precipitously over the last year. And I think that the reason there are more people being allowed in is that businesses tell us that they need the contributions of those immigrants. I mean, that's certainly has a lot of support from Republicans as well as Democrats.
Finally, to Dresden, Ohio. Good morning, Russell. Hello, Russell. Are you there?
Yes.
Go right ahead.
Yes, I am.
Sir.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
My question relates to a bigger picture. Jacques Barzon wrote an interesting history of sociology called From Dawn to Decadence, when he talked about the shift from a modern era to a postmodern era. And I wonder how much of the lack of movement we see in our government is related to an inability to understand what it means to exist and function in a postmodern world, like zero sum on e-commerce. You know, everything on the internet is free now, and that's, you know, from a commercial perspective, that's radical.
Jerry.
Well, I think there's something to that in the sense that One of the problems here is the U.S. economy has changed in a fundamental way in the last two decades. I mean, it's an information economy. It's not a manufacturing-based economy as it once was. And nobody's quite sure. And by the way, the idea
is
that—
Is it ever going to go back to being?
Doubtful. And by the way, the notion that you get a job with a company and you stay with that company forever is pretty much an antiquated notion. So all those things have made the economy different, and it makes people uncertain what the government's role in that economy ought to be. And I'm sure this is something like what it must have been to go through the Industrial Revolution, but it's in a much faster speed now because everything moves much faster. So
I think that's a good point. And you think that's maybe perhaps one reason we see young people better able to adapt and operate, you know, this new millennial generation,
yeah,
than some of us who are a little older.
Susan Page, she's Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Jerry Seib, Executive Washington Editor for The Wall Street Journal. Melinda Hanneberger, Editor-in-Chief of PoliticsDaily.com. Thank you all. I'll be off on Monday and Tuesday visiting WUNC in North Carolina. Back with you on Wednesday. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.